Welcome to The Day Shift, a podcast focusing on shifting the way we think and talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the medical field. I'm Dr. DJ Gaines.
And I'm Dr. Brittani Parker.
And we will be your hosts for today's episode.
Today we are excited to bring to you an episode featuring our guest, Dr. Quentin Yeoman. In this episode, we will be highlighting diversity within medical education, and we'll be talking to Dr. Yeoman about his work on this initiative.
It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Yeoman. He is a former internal medicine chief resident at Northwestern. In fact, he was the second black male to become a chief resident in that department. Currently, he's pursuing a cardiology fellowship in the Midwest. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm so excited to be here and chat about this really important topic, diversity and inclusion within medical education. So thanks for having me.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we have an exciting show tonight. Dr. Yeoman, first of all, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Please, yeah, call me Q by all means.
Okay. Well, thank you, Quentin. We look forward to discussing your involvement with mentorship and about your powerful piece in the Annals of Internal Medicine titled The N-Word, but more about that later. Before we get started, can you give us a brief introduction about yourself?
Yeah, for sure. So I am originally from South Carolina. I was born and raised there, went to high school there, and ultimately went to Brown University for undergrad. I always knew I wanted to do medicine and become a physician. I have a couple of first cousins, actually, who are physicians in my family, and they have been inspirations for me. So when I went to Brown, I was a human biology major. And when I finished at Brown, I figured I wanted to do some research as well. And so I did a research program at Mount Sinai in New York City before ultimately coming to Chicago to Northwestern for medical school. And I've been here ever since. So I did medical school here, residency here, did my chief resident year at Northwestern, and then now I'm a current first-year cardiology fellow at Northwestern.
Okay. It's a really nice pedigree.
Yeah. A lot of purple pride, too.
All right, well, let's transition into our next segment called A Step in Your Shoes. So in this segment, we ask our guests to share something about their background that they would like our listeners to hear about. So this could be anything from a type of food or drink, a song, genre of music, a poem, etc. The goal is not only to get to know our guests in the show, but also to build cultural competency and humility. With that said, Quentin, what would you like to share with us today?
Awesome. I love this. So I wanted to share, you know, I really love music. When I was growing up, I grew up in a Motown household, and, you know, every weekend we were just cranking it. And I actually love to sing as well. So when I was in undergrad, I was in an a cappella group called Shades of Brown. And it was awesome because it was, you know, it basically different shades of brown, so brown people. So it was very diverse. It was multicultural, multi-ethnic, and we sang some awesome jams throughout undergrad. So I love singing, and I think, you know, I'm thinking about my favorite song, taking it back to old school, Donny Hathaway, A Song for You, just takes me there every time.
Yeah. That's a good one. Wow,
it's a great
exciting
one, yeah.
And so how did you guys get started?
So we, you know, Shades of Brown have been existed since 1986, actually. And when I joined it, you know, we had a small group, so like 5 to 10 students. And we would go around to all the quads and sing, particularly in the holidays. And it was just a really, really fun time to connect with the student body at Brown.
Okay, thanks for sharing.
Do you ever incorporate some of the singing with your teaching, with the students or the residents at all?
You know I have to. You know I have to. So I, you know, I kind of am that person who's always in the shower singing too. So I feel like I always have like a song of life going wherever I go. So I do try to incorporate that when I'm teaching with the residents and with the students for sure.
That's great. Great to hear people kind of keeping some of the hobbies that they used to do back in the day, I guess, and then trying to incorporate into like the teaching and the residency in medicine. I commend that. That's awesome.
For sure. It's so important. We got to keep our humanity outside of medicine and outside of the hospital. And for me, that's definitely music.
That's great. I really enjoy that. Well, I guess we can like go on to the next topic. So let's just jump into our discussion. I know personally for me as a person of color, when I was thinking about becoming a physician, having a mentor, especially one of color, was crucial to me for pursuing my dreams. And so I just want to know from your perspective, what important qualities should future physicians be looking for in a mentor?
I think that's such an important question, because as we think about what our futures will look like, it's often really nice to have someone whom you can emulate and whose career you want your career to look like. I think the first thing that's important for, particularly for trainees to think about, are the different types of, you know, quote-unquote mentorship that can exist. So there can be coaching, there could be mentors, and there can be sponsors. And I think it's important to kind of think about those three different types. So a coach is someone who's more kind of skill-focused and who can help you with, for example, public speaking. A mentor is someone who's going to be kind of have that more personal connection with you and can be not only a mentor within your professional life, but also can be a mentor within your personal life. And then third, I think that's important, is a sponsor. And a sponsor can be someone who is going to put you in the right position to succeed. And that includes giving you opportunities that you might not otherwise have had without their sponsorship. Now, obviously, there can be, you know, those don't exist in separate silos. There can be a lot of overlap. But first, thinking about who's going to be your support system, I think thinking about coaching and mentorship and sponsorship is really important. And then the attributes of a strong mentor, I think the first thing is that, you know, a strong mentor has to be open and honest with you. You don't want someone who's going to be just a yes person and say, yes, for sure, do this. But we want them to be honest with you about what the opportunities are for you. And then I think another big thing is, you know, everyone in medicine is very busy. So availability, I think, is a really huge and important component of strong mentorship. And then this question of, you know, underrepresented minority mentorship, I think is really important. For me, I think it's so important, and I've been so fortunate to have mentors who look like me and who have gone through similar challenges as me and who I can really look up to and say, this is someone I'd like to be like, and they've overcome some of the challenges that I might expect to see throughout my career.
That's great. I totally agree. Kind of looking back, though, I wonder how you... I know for me, when I was looking for a mentor that I was a little timid, what do you think are some good ways for future physicians to kind of ask a mentor, or like, what are some tips you have for them?
Yeah, I think one of the important things to remember is that people who are in academic medicine generally love mentorship. And unless they're busy with a project or something that's going on in a specific time, generally people are very approachable and they want to be mentors for you. And so I think, you know, I was also that same way. I had some trepidation about approaching people, but I think it's important to be confident and also to think about what are your personal passions and identifying mentors who align with that passion. And so when you reach out, you have a specific question that you'd like to ask or a specific ask of that mentor. And whether it's via email or in person, I also like to have kind of like short elevator speeches, because particularly if your mentor is going to be kind of higher up, whether they be a dean or a very busy attending, it's important to, when you have their attention, to be able to succinctly express what you'd like to get from them. But in general, I think that trepidation is not necessarily borne out in the sense that a lot of mentors really are excited about being mentors and they welcome people to come kind of within their range and to be able to help them as much as they can.
I think it's so important what you said. I like how you describe the different kinds of people that can help a young learner, coaches, sponsors, and mentors. And Quentin, I know that you helped develop a program in response to the need that you saw to increase mentorship and networking opportunities for underrepresented minorities called STRIVE, which will tell the audience what it stands for, Student to Resident Institutional Vehicle for Excellence. So I want you to tell us a little bit more about that experience, what the program is, and what led you to see the need for the creation of the program.
For sure. You know, as I was mentioning, I went to medical school residency and now fellowship at the same institution. So it's been really nice to have sort of a longitudinal, long-term view of the institution. And one of the things that I recognized is, you know, there were a lot of efforts within the diversity and inclusion space, but part of the challenge in academic medicine is that oftentimes the medical school is completely siloed from the hospital. And so medical students, while they're going through their activities, they're in classes, or they're ultimately end up on the wards, a lot of their didactic sessions are at the medical school, and there's very limited interaction with the residents. And one of the things that I noticed, I had an awesome internal medicine resident when I was a third-year student. His name was Dr. Ike Gokosa. He's actually a heart failure attending now at Northwestern. And he used to go through PowerPoint slides with us with EKGs. And I thought that was really cool to see someone who looks like me in the years ahead who's doing something that I was interested in doing. I was always interested in internal medicine, interested in cardiology. And I thought that, you know, it shouldn't be that just one person is taking their time to do this. We should have a format and a place where all students can gain this insight from residents. And so that was kind of where the idea was born out. And so we created Strive, in which the program, all mentors who are underrepresented minorities, all residents who are underrepresented minorities, serve as mentors for students who are underrepresented minorities at Northwestern. And it's really nice because we have kind of three pillars of programming. So one pillar is curriculum review sessions. And so for the first 2 years for M1 and M2, we have underrepresented minority and allied residents cover review sessions for their classes. The second component is panel discussions. And so we have students who ask additional questions about the residency process. And the nice thing is that a lot of our residents are in the myriad specialties. And so we have surgeons, we have people in internal medicine, we have neurologists, we have really a good breadth of exposure for the students. And so, you know, we hopefully are providing them with a little bit of education, obviously, but then some exposure that might prompt them or inspire them to go into one of those specialties. And then the third, and I think probably one of the most important components, are the social events that we have. It's so important to create an environment that is comfortable for underrepresented minority students. And I think that can be a challenge oftentimes. And it's kind of like I sometimes think about, you know, the FUBU model, like for us, by us. Sometimes we have to create those spaces in order for them to be authentic. And I think the nice thing is that Strive is able to create that space.
That's great. So I know that Dr. Diane Wayne, the Vice Dean for Medical Education at Northwestern, helped to sponsor the Strive program. And we were able to connect with her before the show. And so this is what she had to say. Quote, "The biggest thing I did was stay out of the way. Quentin came to see me about an idea he had for mentorship for our students by peer mentors. Because he was a recent Northwestern graduate and someone I respected, I knew and trusted that he had the pulse of the student body. So it's basically what I did. I helped with the funding and dedicated a staff member in our Office of Diversity and Inclusion who also played a huge role. As an experienced academic, I think sometimes faculty try too hard to make things perfect. In this case, we did not expect perfect curricular alignment. We did not dictate which topics to hold review sessions on or try to achieve additional education faculty-driven goals. We gave Quentin and his colleagues the space to plan and imagine and develop and stayed out of their way. I think autonomy and flexibility are key when involving students and residents," end quote. So I
wow.
think, yeah, so, you know, she had a lot of trust in you, and I think that her comment just highlights how experienced she is in leadership, you know.
Yes, and I think that is, and, you know, we talked a little bit about sponsorship, and I want to thank Dr. Wayne for being really an undying sponsor and mentor for me and for Strive. And it takes really that dedication from the leadership, because if you think about when you're starting something new, you're going to need buy-in from the people who are running the education and running the curriculum. And so we were so fortunate that we had that support from the beginning.
That's wonderful. And I think the program itself can be a source of inspiration for other programs, like looking to create that mentorship, especially with the underrepresented minorities. Kind of along those lines, you know, this is a wonderful thing you guys created. And this is, I think, should be like as a model that other people should use.
But thank you.
What have you noticed some ways that other training programs have some pitfalls when they're trying to support underrepresented residents? Like, what are some ways that they can, you know, what are some ways that you notice they struggle, and what are some ways that they could potentially overcome that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think every program, or at least most programs, are trying to think about what are the best ways to help support their underrepresented minority trainees. There was a recent JAMA Internal Medicine article that I was just reading that was just looking at the disparate experiences of discrimination for medical students. And it wasn't surprising that underrepresented minority, women, LGBTQ, medical students experienced more discrimination than their white counterparts. And I think that the first step is really acknowledging that that gap exists because, you know, medical education is already hard enough and, you know, the pressures to do well in classes and then to ultimately go onto the wards where there's a lot more subjectiveness about the evaluation process. That in and of itself is stressful. But then when you tack on the additional layer of potential discrimination, it can be so burdensome for a lot of not just medical students, but also residents and fellows and just general medical trainees. So I think the first step is acknowledging that it's a problem. And I think secondly, what's really important is to include and empower those who are going through it to help to address it. And I think that there's a challenge though, because there's a fine line between having people address the issue, but then the minority tax that we've all kind of heard about, where people who are underrepresented minorities in a given space might feel that they are charged with fixing everything that's related to diversity. And so I think that that's definitely a challenge and something, it's kind of a fine line that programs and institutions will have to walk. But at the same time, without input from underrepresented minorities, we can't know or identify what exactly the issues are and ultimately fix them. And so, you know, I think this comes up in evaluations, and it can contribute a lot to imposter syndrome, which is something that, you know, obviously anyone can be a victim of, but I think it unduly affects underrepresented minority trainees a lot more often. And so I think being aware of it and then being very proactive about either creating opportunities or creating a space similar to Strive where people can open up about it. I think that's one of the powers of Strive is that, you know, if you do go through something, sometimes just the catharsis of sharing it with other people can be helpful. So just even just saying it out loud. But then secondly, the nice thing is that residents who've gone through similar things potentially can share, you know, what they went through and how they were able to overcome.
Quentin, I really appreciate your insight and your thoughts on this topic. One thing I don't think I've really thought about very much is empowering those who are underrepresented in medicine or, you know, any other category to be a part of the change. And I think oftentimes we can identify it, acknowledge it, and then try and fix it without really thinking about including those who are involved to help come up with solutions themselves because they know, you know, their community the best and what may or may not work.
Exactly. And then I think it's also really interesting because when people are deciding what specialties they're going to go into, their experiences on these rotations play a huge role. And so, you know, we talk a lot about it being choosing a specialty is kind of like finding your tribe. And I think sometimes experiences that people might have, whether it's discrimination or microaggressions, might lead people away from certain specialties, even if they might have flourished in that specialty. And so I think it also can play a role in people's individual choices and what they end up doing with their careers. And so I think it's such an important thing for us to focus on and to really drill down. I think each institution has to think about specifically what are my students going through and what are my trainees going through and really drill down at that in order to find solutions that will work.
I really like that you touched on the minority tax because I know I can almost guarantee that all of us have probably experienced that at some point. And I think it's something that we, you know, as people, as underrepresented residents that are even medical students across the board, is that sometimes we feel like a sense of responsibility that we must address this issue. And then when we start to feel that burnout or kind of that, you know, the taxing of kind of doing all that work, we feel guilty. And I think, you know, just recognizing that it's a thing and, you know, trying to get help from, you know, other underrepresented residents or students or allies or even just letting the staff know, you know, sometimes they need to take a break. I think I think until recently, you know, I kind of always felt like a sense of guilt, not like giving it my all in a sense, but at the same time, I know it's important for my mental health as well. So it's definitely a fine line. And I think, you know, it's a huge, I'm really glad you touched on that point, the minority tax.
Yeah. And I think it's so important to think about too, it's not every underrepresented minority trainee's battle to fight either. And so I think that it's important for people to think about what they're passionate about. And if they are not passionate about doing this type of work, it's 100% okay,
right?
Because that's part of the burden is that we, you know, I'm interested in cardiology and I'm interested in heart failure. And so I want to do heart failure research. But, you know, is my institution dragging me to every SNMA meeting or every, you know, meeting where they're, or putting me on every poster, right? You know, for me personally, I love this. And so it's important for me to be there because I want to be there and show, you know, we have a great institution. Here's what we're doing for diversity, but also here's what we're doing outside of diversity, right? This is why we're such a great institution is because we have excellent medicine and excellent research and excellent education going on. But if you don't feel passionate about that or it's not something that you want to do, it's 100% okay. And I think that that's something that's also important is for people to recognize that it's okay to not be involved at all in the diversity space if you're underrepresented. And for institutions also to realize that, and that's one way we can mitigate it as well.
I think that brings up an important topic too of wellness, that it's important to be thoughtful about what initiatives and you get involved in, and not everything that's presented to you do you have to jump at, but like you said, Quentin, to really make sure that you are involved in things that you're passionate about so that you don't have that burnout.
Exactly. And that's the, and you know, as I mentioned, you know, we all know how taxing it is just to be a student or just to be a resident within your given subspecialty. And so if you are going to take that additional time to do something outside of that space, make sure it's something that you love, you know? I think that's a key takeaway.
Oh, absolutely. This is great. So I'm really glad that we're touching like on all this. Want to transition because we want to talk about your article, which was featured in the Annals of Internal Medicine. It's titled The N-Word. And it's very powerful. It really hit home for me. I really enjoyed reading it. And I really encourage like all our listeners to read it as well. There will be a link posted in the show notes at the end of this. But I just wanted to just hear from you. You know, can you tell us your experience and what you learned?
Yeah, for sure. So this was, you know, one of the more challenging experiences in residency. I was a third-year resident, and I was on the cardiology service, the inpatient cardiology service. And I was actually only covering for a half a day for one of my co-residents who was in clinic. And when I arrived, you know, we're getting signed out, and I had heard this patient had been belligerent with nursing staff and with other members of the team. And it appeared that the symptoms that he was relaying were not cardiac in nature. And so when I got signed out, I found out that he was, you know, basically ready for discharge. And because of everything that had happened and the way that he had treated a lot of the other staff members, you know, the intern asked me to go in with her to discharge the patient. And obviously, you know, being the senior resident and kind of, you know, one of the things that came up when I was unpacking this whole experience was, you know, just the team dynamics and the hierarchy of the team and how because of, you know, my black race, even as I think about, you know, the future and leading a team and things like that, how will it play a role? How will my race play a role? So we went in to see the patient, and as we're kind of explaining that he's ready for discharge, he becomes increasingly belligerent. And he starts to curse at us, and he's saying, you know, get the F out of my room. And it comes to the point where he's actually kind of physically beginning to almost get out of his bed. And so I just turned to the intern and I said, you know, let's call security. And as we're walking out, he screams towards the door, I'm not playing your effing nigger games. And my heart just, you know, dropped. I couldn't believe it. And the intern, you know, her mouth was agape. She was as surprised as anything. And it took a while to kind of process everything. I was just so shocked. You know, I had my white coat. It's interesting, as I go around the hospital, I always wear my white coat because I think it's so important, and we're often mistaken for other members of the team. And as we all know, every member of the team is important, but we've also gone through the process of medical school and residency training, and so, you know, we are physicians, and so I think it's important to be seen as such. So I went, you know, we went into the team room, and at first I didn't know what to do. You know, I said, let's call case management, let's call security, and ultimately I had really supportive, first of all, my program director was super supportive and from the beginning, and actually my chief resident, who heard about it kind of through the grapevine, she contacted my program director and said, this is what happened to Quentin, we need to figure something out. And pretty much immediately the response was support. And I think that, I hope that the takeaway from the piece and writing it is how important it is to be present and supportive when we go through these kinds of things. And it's not just racial either. It can be gender. It can be sexual orientation. And it can also not just come from patients, but other staff members. And I think it's important for us all to realize that part of the job is that we're going to have these encounters with people where there's hate embedded in the interaction. And in order for us to be effective at our jobs, we need the leaders and our colleagues, really, to be as supportive as possible. So I think it was a huge learning experience, and something that I'll hope to take with me. And the other thing I think that's really important in the moment is to call it out. And actually, this is one of the behavior changes that I personally had after this experience. For example, if I'm in with my team and a patient is treating my female colleague in a disrespectful manner, I call it out right there. And you just got to say that this behavior is unacceptable. And most of the times when you call it out, I think when you're really honest about it, patients tend to respond and it's able to be nipped right there. But I think that that's another important point.
I completely agree, Quentin. In my work as an attending physician and an associate program director, that's one thing that I've worked on in the past few years, is that when there's a comment that's made about a medical student or resident, and sometimes it's, like you said, it's not just race, it may be an accent that they have, and it may be a comment that almost is a put down, mm-hmm. that I now address it in real time, there with the patient, with compassion, but also with the goal of letting the learner know that I support them, I'm identifying this, we're talking about it, and then just reinforcing that this person who is on the team is specifically supposed to be here, and they are part of your care, and we expect all members of the staff to be treated with respect, just as you are treated with respect here at our facility.
Yes, and I think it, honestly, the first time I said it, I don't know if you kind of agree with this, but I approached it with a little bit of trepidation, because at the same time, we're all trained and it's in our hearts to do the best for the patient, right? And we're always obviously looking out for the patient. And so as you mentioned, it's kind of a fine line. As leaders of our teams, we also have to protect those who are on our team. And what I found is in the handful of times that we have had to kind of say something like this, that oftentimes patients respond in an appropriate manner. And I think it also changes the tenor of the interaction of the team from then on. And it doesn't have to compromise, as you mentioned, it doesn't have to compromise their care in any bit. I think that's an important point too.
Right, compromise their care or the relationship. I have found that patients understand us a little bit better. We're able to move past it and continue the healing that we're doing.
Exactly. Totally agree.
100%. No, that's wonderful. And another thing, too, that really struck home with me at the end of your article, you stated, it goes, quote, "I know that even if I did achieve the level of full professor, no coat would ever be white enough to overcome my black skin in some patients' eyes," end quote. And I feel like the black skin, that could be, you know, you could change that to gender, you could change that to other races. And it kind of reminded me of I think there was an instance when LeBron James, he was about to play, and then they wrote some like racial expletives like on his property. And so I think this could go, you know, be expanded to many different positions. But how would you encourage underrepresented minorities to overcome some of the implicit bias that they may face from their patients?
I think this is a really important question. And I think that the first thing to acknowledge is that the tension that exists between the bias that they're experiencing and their internal want or need to do right by the patient is normal, right? Because I think that that's one of the challenges, is like, as a team member and as a physician or as a medical student, it's so important for us to do right by the patient. And it's a challenge. It's like an internal challenge and internal struggle. So I think that this recognizing that that's normal is the first step. And then secondly, I think this is where the support system comes in and where the support system is really important. That's why associate PDs and program directors and, you know, even vice deans of education, that's why these leaders exist, because they are the support system to whom we can go when issues like this arise. And so, again, I think it's really important for the members of the team to call it out in the moment. And then I think it's really important to think about debriefing after an event occurs. And that's really powerful because all of the members of the team who were there can hear actually what happened. And sometimes it's a microaggression that, unless you're from that specific group, you might not have even recognized it as an issue. And so that's why, you know, talking about it afterwards as a team can really be helpful. And then obviously the attending should be there because they're going to have the most experience probably with dealing with things like this, and they can help to frame it for the other learners who might be present. But then other learners can take something from that experience too. A lot of medical education is not just learning the book smarts, right? It's not just learning about the science. It's about learning how to deal with people. And I think that this is one of the issues, unfortunately, that comes up just when you deal with people, because there's going to, you know, be a lot of otherism and a lot of hate that's out there. But it can be a learning opportunity for everyone involved as long as we do debrief afterwards.
Now, as you may have heard, the USMLE recently changed step one to pass-fail. So we just wanted to get your thoughts on how you think this might affect the recruitment and application process for medical students from diverse backgrounds.
I think this is going to have a really profound effect in a positive way, actually. You know, I think the USMLE step one has been a roadblock, one of many that contributes to a really leaky pipeline for underrepresented minorities in residency training. And so I think helping to remove an additional barrier that might be in place is going to be really important. My hope is with this change that there will be a shift towards a more holistic review in which it's not just about the grades that one has gotten or a single test score, but it's more about the person as a whole or the applicant as a whole. So that's what I hope with will be the shift. I think there will be challenges, obviously, as with any change. And one of the challenges I foresee is, you know, when programs think about how they are going to go about recruiting residents into different specialties, there's already been application inflation, so they're getting thousands of applicants and interviewing hundreds of interviewees. And so being very specific about defining what are we looking for in our residents is going to become paramount.
I think that's really good, Quentin. One question I have in my mind is for those students who come from schools that maybe are, you know, DO or maybe perceived as, you know, not as great training, you know, institutions, if those students may have less opportunity to make themselves seem like they're standing out. Is that something that you think may be an issue?
I think that's one of the additional challenges of this type of a process, but I think that's where the holistic review is going to become very important. And a lot of times, you know, programs will use these scoring systems where they put in a lot of data in order to make it easier on them to kind of help to weed out applicants. And part of that scoring system obviously will have where the person went to school, or it potentially could have the type of degree, the type of medical degree that they're getting. But I think that when we think about holistic review, and particularly when we think about ensuring that our residency programs have a diverse workforce, it'll be important to weight things differently. And so if we're weighting things, we'll have to consider weighting MD versus DO similarly, or we'll have to consider giving additional weight to people who will add to the diversity of a residency program. And so the holistic review portion, obviously, we're going to want to find really strong candidates who are going to be great physicians. But also, we recognize that great physicians need to be in a diverse environment in order to be the best that they can be. And so I hope that taking into account that within the holistic review will help to kind of mitigate some of that.
I think that's wonderful. You know, one thing I was, you know, thinking, another positive aspect of it is just the whole anxiety component with step one, especially for those that they don't get the score that they want. and then they just don't have the confidence going into their clinical rotations, going to step two, et cetera. So I think that is a positive, potentially positive aspect with this new change. So I guess we'll see how the change goes, and hopefully, you know, like you said, I agree, hopefully they approach with a more holistic view with these residency application processes.
And that's such an important point, because when we think about being underrepresented, a lot of times we're not as comfortable in spaces where others are more comfortable. And imposter syndrome plays a huge role. And even though we are competent, sometimes when a single test score, because it has so much weight, it can really crush our confidence. And I think step one obviously happens in a pivotal time in medical school, where you're transitioning from second year to third year. And so you really need to go into third year very confident, because so much of the grading system is subjective during third year too. And so I think that's an important point about just needing that additional boost potentially, or mitigating that, needing that boost with this change in step one.
My hope is that now that it'll be pass fail, that those medical students don't feel like doors are closed, so they can still feel free to explore different options and different specialties that
for sure
they felt that they wouldn't be able to have access to.
100%.
Thanks so much for the discussion, Quentin. We really enjoyed chatting with you. So before we leave, we wanted to ask you if you had any practical points that you wanted our audience to take away, implement in their lives.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been an awesome discussion, and really, really a pleasure to join you guys on this podcast. So thank you so much. I think a couple of just practical things to think about. The first is really, this is a very broad statement, but just to remember to follow your passion in whatever you do. And I think that that's the key to success, really, and the key to happiness. And whatever you do in medicine, to follow your passion. And the second thing is, when you see something, speak out about it. And whether that's discrimination or something in patient care, no matter what the case may be, sometimes if you feel that little kind of voice in your gut that's driving you to speak, just speak out, because that is always going to be helpful. And I think the third and last thing is really just to be a mentor. You know, I had a saying when I was in high school. I've always kind of thought about mentorship and loved mentorship. And it went, you're never too old to need a mentor, and you're never too young to be one. And I think it's just really important, no matter what stage you are in life, you have something to give to other people. And so give freely.
Thank you so much for all those points, Quentin. And for our audience, if you want to know more information about the Strive program, or even get some more tips on mentorship, feel free to contact Quentin at Strive4Mentorship, and that's the number 4, at gmail.com. So that's Strive4, the number 4, mentorship at gmail.com.
Another heartfelt thank you to Quentin. We appreciate you coming on the show and carving out some time for us. We also encourage our audience to continue this topic online. We'd love to hear your stories in regards to this topic, any specific barriers or challenges you have faced. We will have additional resources, including a transcript and summary, on our website at www.thedayshift.com. And again, the day shift is DEI, day shift. Please feel free to contact us there and follow us on social media, both on Twitter and Instagram at The Day Shift. You can also email us at thedayshift@gmail.com.
Thank you so much, Quentin. It was great to have you all on today. And tune in, guys, for future episodes.
The Day Shift podcast and its guests provide general information and entertainment, but not medical advice. Before making any changes to your medical treatment or execution of your treatment plan, please consult with your doctor or personal medical team. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by The Day Shift. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the podcast does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by The Day Shift team are those of each individual and do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of The Day Shift team and its guests, employers, sponsors, or organizations we are affiliated with. Season 1 of the Day Shift podcast is proudly sponsored by the American Medical Association's Joan F. Giambalvo Fund for the Advancement of Women
and the American College of Physicians Southern California Region 3 chapter.
Our theme music is brought to you by Chris Dingman. Learn more at www.chrisdingman.com.